Amendments to the Constitution of the United States, Article 19. The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. August 26, 1920.
This is Inheritance, presented by the National Broadcasting Company in cooperation with the American Legion. Stories out of the great fabric of the American past. Stories of our inheritance. Today, their rights and nothing less.
On the second Tuesday of November in the year of our Lord 1920, an event took place in these United States that many citizens were convinced would never happen. Less than 2 months before, the 19th Amendment to the Constitution was declared in effect by the Secretary of State, and for the first time in our history, women voted. Not quite the first time, though. 50 years before, one woman had voted because she believed that women, as well as men, were citizens. Her name was Susan B. Anthony.
I was born in South Adams, Massachusetts, the daughter of Daniel Anthony, a Quaker, and Lucy Reed, a Baptist. I suppose the progeny of any such union was foredestined to be unorthodox. Certainly I was all of that. But I was blessed with an understanding father who was far in advance of his time. We were fairly well-to-do. By some standards, we were even considered wealthy. And so it was all but inconceivable to those who knew us that I should do anything but sit at home and play the part of a young lady. Because I had other ideas, and father was kind enough to indulge me, I was sent away to boarding school to be educated. To be sure, the place was known as a seminary for females. And the curriculum was designed to teach the principles of humility, morality, and a love of virtue, all in capital letters. Nevertheless, it was the beginning of an education, and that is what I desired. Unfortunately, my stay at the school was all too short. I was summoned home by my father to receive some shocking news.
I don't know how to tell thee, Susan, but I believe it best to do these things simply and without unnecessary embellishment.
Yes, Father.
To be blunt, my business has failed.
Father.
That is why I sent for thee.
But what does it all mean? How serious is it?
Serious indeed. Everything we once owned now belongs to our creditors.
But everything is such a general term. How much? What things?
I have the inventory list. Look at it.
Why, this is incredible.
Mm-hmm. But true.
Mother's wedding present, so that isn't fair.
It is the law.
But the tea and coffee from our pantry shelves.
My spectacles and the family Bible. All these belong to the creditors.
But this, surely not this.
Oh, yes, yes. Clothing and underclothing of the wife and daughters.
Are we to be turned naked into the streets?
No. I have let thee see the worst. There is a hopeful side, too.
Oh, thank heavens.
Thy mother's brother has already entered a bid for all our personal possessions. He has promised to restore them to us at once. I, of course, will repay him the moment my new business permits me.
New business? You're starting again, Father.
Certainly, but not here. We're going to move, Susan. We're going to a place called Hard Scrabble.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, I agree. The name is a forbidding one. I shall have it changed. Perhaps we shall call it Center Falls.
Well, I shall like that much better. And I can teach school there, Father, to help with the expenses.
Yes, indeed. I was counting on that.
Father was as good as his word. We were not turned naked into the streets, and hardscrabble did indeed become center falls. More than that, Father rebuilt his ruined fortunes, and we were soon quite prosperous again. It was now possible for me to stop working and become a lady once more. But I had had my taste of independence and become intoxicated by it. I was at the age now where people were beginning to speak rather desperately about my prospects. Meaning, of course, my prospects of becoming someone's wife. There were suitors, but I had other ideas.
Do you think it's likely to rain today, Miss Susan?
It might.
We need it for the crops.
Yes, it's been very dry.
Oh, up there.
Well, why are we stopping?
Miss Susan... Miss Susan, may I have your permission to speak?
Why do you need my permission? You've managed very well without it.
Well, you know what I mean.
I suppose you are going to propose to me.
Well, Miss Susan, well, you have a way of coming straight to the point.
I was raised to speak my mind.
Yes. Well, it has its advantages. But now you've left me without much to add. Fact is, Miss Susan, I'd be honored to have you for my wife.
Why?
Well, I beg your pardon?
Why would you be honored? Why me particularly?
Well, because you're a fine figure of a woman and one I'd be proud to call my wife.
And rear your children?
Well, yes. Yes, rear my children.
Thank you very much. But I was born free, and I rather like it that way. It was a momentous decision I made that day. The year was 1849, and those were stirring times. I remember one morning in my father's home.
Morning, Susan.
Morning, Father.
So there is my newspaper. Hmm? I've been looking everywhere for it.
Oh, I'm sorry, Father. Here, take it.
I don't want to deprive thee of it.
No, I'm through.
Very well, then. Tell me, Susan, what is in here that is so interesting to thee?
The gold rush, Father.
And that appeals to thee?
Oh, I realize it's out of the question for me, Father, but I find it exciting just the same. Does that sound foolish to you?
Not at all. I find it exciting, too. But there is even more exciting news if you look for it.
Well, what do you mean?
This item about the married woman's property bill.
I didn't see that. What is it?
New York State has passed a law adjusting certain ancient inequities and giving married women the right to own property.
Oh, let me see.
Now, don't tear the paper.
Excuse me, Father.
Besides, there is not much in this story except an account of the passage of the bill and an editorial denouncing it roundly.
Denouncing it?
Of course. The editorial, after all, was written by a man.
But you don't denounce it.
No. But then I am a Quaker. I have been taught to believe in the basic equality of all God's creatures.
Even women?
Yes, child. Even women.
It is not often that you can date the beginning of a life's work from a single event. But I date mine from that morning when I became interested in the married woman's property bill. I wanted to know who was responsible for its passage, and I learned that it was, naturally enough, a woman. Her name was Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and she was the leader of what she called the rebellion against masculine monopoly. I wanted to know more of her and her work, and so I went to a meeting to hear her speak.
The legal code of America, like that of every other country in the world, has relegated the women to a position of undignified inferiority. In accordance with this code, every woman is a perpetual minor. She can never grow up to legal majority. If she marries, she becomes the property of her husband. If she remains a spinster, she is obliged to assign her property to a male guardian. No married woman is allowed to sue for breach of contract, to retain the wages she has earned for her work, or to receive damages for injury done to her person or her character. In every case, the husband is the beneficiary. He is not only the arbiter of her fate and fortune, but the owner of her children. He can give away or will away the children without the mother's consent. And even though he is proved to be a degenerate or a drunkard, he becomes the children's sole custodian in the event of divorce. A man is allowed to beat his wife, his children, and his dog. And a woman is not allowed to divorce her husband even on the ground of cruelty. Every American woman is, in short, a slave.
As I listened to Elizabeth Cady Stanton speak, it was like hearing a voice put to my own beliefs. I resolved to meet this woman and join her in her fight.
And so began a lifelong friendship between two pioneers of a worldwide movement whose repercussions were to be felt down through the decades. Susan had found the courage and the encouragement to voice her own beliefs, and she lost little time in making her existence known in the smugly masculine world of her day. In Rochester, New York, in August of 1853, a teacher's convention was the occasion of her first public utterance.
Oh, isn't it exciting, Miss Anthony? This is my first teacher's convention, you know.
I find it more disturbing than exciting.
Disturbing? But why?
Well, look around you. At least two-thirds of us here are women. Yet it is only the men who really take part in the proceedings.
But of course. Well, isn't that the way these things are always conducted?
That's why I find it disturbing.
I'm sure I don't see why.
I don't believe in minority rule. Do you actually believe that all wisdom and knowledge is vested in those creatures up front just because they happen to be men? Do you concede that they need no aid, no counsel from the majority here?
Well, I never looked at it in quite that way.
No, and neither did most of the others. To me, the most humiliating fact of all is that these women around us are perfectly satisfied with the inferior position assigned them.
My goodness. Well, you know, it's too bad you can't make a speech here.
I intend to.
To make a speech?
Of a sort.
Oh, but you can't. Well, not here. It just isn't done.
The rules say that anyone paying a dollar is entitled to all the rights and privileges of a delegate. Well, I have paid my dollar, and I intend to speak.
Oh, dear.
If the idea distresses you, you can always change your seat.
Oh, no, I wouldn't miss it for the world. But what will Mr. Davies say?
The fact that our chairman is an instructor at West Point and is here in full military regalia is hardly going to stop me.
But he looks so imposing up there, so forbidding.
Yes, the great Mogul in person.
We're going to reconvene.
Fellow delegates, the meeting will resume. The subject under discussion is why the profession of teacher is not as much respected as that of lawyer, doctor, or minister.
Mr. President! Mr. President!
What will the lady have?
Mr. President, I wish to speak to the question under discussion.
What did you say, madam?
I wish to speak to the question under discussion.
Yes, I thought that is what you said. Gentlemen of the convention, what is your pleasure?
Well, a woman has never spoken at our convention. Is that lady back there some kind of radical? I say, let her speak. She's a delegate like the rest of us.
For fully 30 minutes, the battle raged on the floor of the convention. One male delegate after another expressed himself, and all the while the neat little woman far in the back of the hall remained upon her feet because she was afraid she would lose the floor and end the debate. Finally, the question was put to a vote, with only the men being permitted to take part.
The results of the voting having been tabulated by the secretary, I'm ready to announce the outcome. On the proposition, should the lady delegate be permitted to speak, those voting aye, 104. Those voting no, 102. The ayes have it. Madam, you have heard the will of the convention. You may speak to the question.
Thank you, Mr. President. Most of us have probably forgotten the question by now. It was why the profession of teacher is not as much respected as that of lawyer, doctor, or minister. It seems to me you fail to comprehend the cause of the disrespect of which you complain. Do you not see that so long as society says woman has not brains enough to be a doctor, lawyer, or minister, but has plenty to be a teacher, every man of you who condescends to teach tacitly admits before all Israel and the sun that he has no more brains than a woman.
The reaction to Miss Anthony's speech was, to say the least, mixed. But she had attracted attention to her cause. She was alternately praised and damned in the press of the nation, but people were beginning to listen. And then, just when her work gave promise of bearing fruit, there was a long and terrible interruption, the Civil War. All suffrage work stopped until the nation again was whole. Then Elizabeth Cady Stanton formed a newspaper called The True Republic. Its motto,
men, their rights and nothing more. Women, their rights and nothing less.
The paper was dedicated to the task of securing for American women their privileges as people. At last, the climate seemed right for the movement, and Susan had high hopes when she talked to one of the political leaders of the day.
Yes, indeed, Miss Anthony. I know very well the purpose of your visit. And may I add, I sympathize with it completely.
Oh, that's very gratifying, Senator. Naturally, I know there must be an amendment to the Constitution if the newly freed slaves are to get the vote.
And it is your hope that this amendment will include the members of your sex?
Is it too much to ask? We are also former slaves, you know.
Well, I would hardly put it that way.
Only because you've never been a woman, Senator.
I can't very well deny that fact, I suppose.
Senator, I have read the draft of the proposed 14th Amendment. 3 times the word male is used.
Yes, I am aware of that.
We want it stricken from the amendment wherever it appears.
May I ask who wants this, Miss Anthony?
Every female. The appearance of that single word in the final draft would mean the defeat of everything we have fought and struggled for.
Miss Anthony, I must be very frank with you. As I said before, my sympathies are with you. If I may speak for a number of my colleagues in the Senate, theirs are likewise with you. But
there is always that one small word, but.
There is another word, neither so small nor perhaps so inoffensive. The word is expediency. I warned you that I would be frank. The best minds in the country sincerely believe that at this particular time, political expediency dictates against any such deletion as you propose.
I see.
You understand, then?
No, Senator. I do not understand. But I do see. I see that everything we've worked for is to be destroyed at this late date by your political expediency. Good day, sir.
That single decision regarding the use of the word male in the 14th Amendment was the greatest blow the cause of suffrage had ever sustained.
There is just one course for me to follow now. I must begin again at the bottom and work without cessation until we compel the Constitution of the United States to recognize the political rights of women.
You are working late again, Susan. How does the amendment read now?
I know it by heart. The right of the citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude.
On account of race, color, sex, or previous condition of servitude. Oh, surely they'll include the word. So many leaders in the party have committed themselves, have declared their belief in the right of women to vote.
In principle only. I'm afraid we're going to run into the same phrase that ruined us last time. Such an infuriating phrase. There's no way to argue against it. I'm sorry, Mrs. Stanton. I'm sorry, Miss Anthony. But it is not politically expedient at this time.
¶¶ Those were the words the politicians and the statesmen again used. The time was not right. It was not yet politically expedient to give women the right to be citizens. The 15th Amendment became a part of the Constitution in 1870, and the vital word was missing. By this time, the National Woman Suffrage Association had been formed, with Mrs. Stanton as president and Susan Anthony on the executive committee.
We have so much hope and pluck that none but the good Father knows how we have suffered when with the 14th and 15th Amendments, even friends have crucified us. But we shall fight on. A way will open to us.
Elizabeth, I think I may have found the way.
Found it? What are you talking about, Susan?
The 14th Amendment. I've been studying it closely. It's so much longer than the 15th. There's so much more room for doubt.
Oh, the finest legal minds in the country have been looking for that loophole, my dear. It's no use.
But it is open to interpretation. Now listen. All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. No state shall make any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, and so on. All through that first section, they refer to citizens, not to male citizens.
Yes, I know all that. I've been over it myself, time and again. The language makes no reference to age either. Surely you don't believe this gives children the right to vote?
But it doesn't deny us the right, Elizabeth. That's my point.
Oh, Susan, Susan, you're beating your head against a wall.
No, no, I have an idea. I mean to prove my point.
Prove it?
The presidential election is being held this year. I am going to Rochester and vote.
No. Oh, I can't let you do that.
I must. It's my duty as a citizen. Neither you nor anyone else has a right to stop me. Don't you see? That's the very point I mean to prove.
And in the election of 1872 in Rochester, New York, Susan Anthony did cast her vote. She was immediately arrested for fraudulent voting and given a public trial. The result was foreordained, but the trial itself attracted nationwide publicity. Before sentencing, she was interviewed by the judge in his chambers.
Now, Miss Anthony, I know what an ordeal this has been for you, but I want you to understand what I must do.
Yes, Your Honor.
The law carries with it penalties. The violation you have committed calls for a jail sentence, a fine of $100, or both. And as you know, I must impose the sentence.
And as you must know, Your Honor, I must decline to accept it.
Decline? Well, my good woman, you can't decline a sentence.
Well, nevertheless, I have no intention of paying a fine of $100. I suppose if I am bodily thrown into prison, I have little choice in the matter. But I can tell you this, with all due respect. I shall never voluntarily walk into prison for the commission of an act which I steadfastly refuse to believe is a crime.
It is obvious to me that you intend, madam, to make a martyr of yourself.
If that becomes necessary, yes, sir. I can only repeat that I do not propose to pay the fine.
Nor did she pay the fine. And strangely enough, she never served a day in jail. But her act dramatized her cause and put it uppermost in the minds of thinking people throughout the land. In the years that followed, she redoubled her efforts until her very name became a byword in most American homes. So quickly was the climate of public opinion changing that by 1890, the Washington Star could proudly proclaim her the most remarkable woman in the world. At last, in 1900, at the age of 80, she resigned the presidency of the National Woman Suffrage Association, and at the convention held in February of that year, Dr. Anna Howard Shaw paid her a last glowing tribute.
A little over 100 years ago, there came men who told us what freedom is and what freedom may become. Later, women with the same love of it in their hearts said, "There is no sex in freedom. Whatever it makes possible for men, it will make possible for women." A few of these daring souls went forth to blaze the path. Elizabeth Stanton and Susan Anthony still stand on the summit, grace, glorious figures. Souls like theirs can never rest in all the eternities of God.
She did not live to see her own final triumph. The 19th Amendment to the Constitution was not ratified until 13 years after her death. But Susan B. Anthony had done her work well. The amendment was ratified because, at long last, it had become politically expedient.
You have been listening to Inheritance, presented by the National Broadcasting Company in cooperation with the American Legion. And now it's our privilege to hear from the National Vice Chairman of the Accident Prevention Committee of the American Legion, Department of Minnesota, Mr. George J. Kaisersat. Mr. Kaisersat.
Motor vehicle accidents have the nation's number one killer. They are the leading cause of accidental deaths among persons between the ages of 1 to 36. They kill more children between the ages of 1 and 14 than any other cause, more than polio, heart disease, cancer, or tuberculosis. During the last Christmas and New Year's holidays alone, 687 died in motor accidents. This is a tragic waste of life. The Accident Prevention Committee of the American Legion's Americanism Commission has long realized the costliness of this shocking death toll and has maintained research and correction programs designed to determine causes and remedies for such needless loss of life. Individual Legion departments and posts have initiated outstanding safety programs. Notable among these is a school safety patrol program which has been maintained for the past 25 years by the American Legion Department of Minnesota. The school safety patrol program originated in St. Paul, Minnesota 35 years ago and was adopted for sponsorship by the state's American Legion in 1930. 25,000 youngsters are active every year throughout the state of Minnesota through this program, and not one child has ever been killed at an intersection controlled by the school safety patrol members. Minnesota's Legionville, an annual school safety patrol camp, may be cited as dramatic proof that education and training in traffic and safety rules pays off in the saving of lives. We urge every citizen to obey traffic signals and signs and to avoid carelessness. Our inheritance teaches us that each single American life is precious. Let us remember this well and halt the heartbreaking loss of American lives which occurs on the nation's highways.
Thank you, Mr. Kaisersat. Next week, Inheritance will take you on another journey through the pages of American history. Today's story was written by Gilbert Braun. Featured in the cast were Ann Seymour, Virginia Payne, Lola Pizer, and Youth Ruth York. Also heard were Dick Hamilton, Joseph Bell, Charles Webster, Sam Gray, and John Larkin. This is Roger Bowman speaking. Inheritance was produced by William Welch and directed by Daniel Sutter. This has been an NBC Radio Network production.
Tonight, hear Cavalcade of Stars on the NBC Radio Network.